The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2015-1107, State of Ohio versus Christopher L. Anderson. For the appellant, Mr. Juhas.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Juhas. I represent the appellant in this case, Christopher Anderson. Madam Chief Justice, if I may, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In June of 2002, 22-year-old Amber Zerker was found by her mother murdered in her apartment. A few months later, in August 22nd of 2002, Christopher Anderson was arrested for the crime of that murder. That is, as we stand here today, 5,031 days, or 13 years and 9 months ago, during the time that, as Article 1, Section 16 of our Constitution says, justice was being administered in this case, the United States invaded Iraq, Saddam Hussein was captured, he was tried, convicted, appealed, and executed.
Well, counsel, if newly discovered DNA evidence demonstrates that somebody committed rape 13 years ago and just now discovered, we don't seem to have a problem with prosecution taking place, do we?
We don't under some circumstances, I would agree, if a defendant can establish.
And a lot of stuff happened, and the same stuff you're wanting to talk about happened.
Well,
history moved on.
History moved on. That's true. But I haven't found a case, quite frankly, Your Honor, where a defendant was pending trial this long. If you look at some of the cases that were cited, some of them are 7 months, some of them are a couple years. I haven't seen any of them 14 years. And of course, one of the differences that we have in this case that we don't have in the hypothetical case that you just suggested with new DNA is that there is no new evidence. In fact, I think it's significant that the Court of Appeals talks about the issue of prosecutorial misconduct. Certainly you don't have that here in the sense that you see in a lot of the classic cases, that you see in some of the cases that are cited where the state conceals favorable evidence. You do, however, have a situation where the first trial, as the Seventh District found and reversed, was a trial that was unfair. So when you look at these cases and the courts, some of them actually shot.
Was the first trial the one where some witness blurted out something that was not to be said?
That was the first trial. Forgive me, when I said the first trial, I meant to say the first trial that proceeded to a verdict. Temporally, you are correct. The first trial was a mistrial where the witness blurted something out and the judge declared a mistrial.
Of the four, the only one in terms of arguably contributing to delay by the prosecution would be the second, where they decided to try and put that evidence in, and that same evidence.
Yes. And
so that one, you could say, is on the prosecution in terms of delay.
You can. One of the things that we have resisted, and I understand that makes that a somewhat more difficult case for this court, one of the things that we've resisted is trying to take a precise formula and try to weigh things back and forth, because there was obviously the period of time that the case was pending in appeal. And ironically, the state cite says one of the situations in this case when Anderson complains about the length of time, the state says, well, geez, just about half the time that this case has been pending has been in the appellate courts. And I mention that because I don't necessarily know that we can start weighing these things one side against the other. I suppose you could say that was something attributable to the state. How does that leave Anderson any better off 14 years later? Because faced as he is with, of course, the clear double jeopardy law that says as long as it's a mistrial, you can try him again. What our proposition?
You have a compelling argument in a way, but you want us to write something that finds a constitutional violation. And it strikes me that it's for us the same dilemma as the case where some judge down in Franklin County County Police Court who just loves the headlines of extreme sentences piles 155 years on. It seemed extreme, but writing a rule that says, well, now you've gone too far. Not so easy.
Not so easy. I don't necessarily know that you can write a rule so much as, I mean, we have ostensibly two jurisdictional bases for being here. One, that it's a case of great public interest. The other is that it involves a substantial constitutional question. Of course, this court leads the other courts. And so many times you see trial courts and appellate courts saying, well, I haven't seen anything from the Ohio Supreme Court where they said this is unconstitutional. And so if nothing more than a ruling from this court say to other courts, listen, look at Section 1 of the Ohio Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, where it talks about the ability of every citizen, the inalienable right to defend his liberty. Look at Article 1, Section 16, where it says that every person in this state in the courts is to have justice administered without denial or delay. We can't write a formula for you, trial courts. We can suggest, as some of the other appellate courts have done, there are things that you should look at. But you have to avoid hanging on to those too dearly so that they become...
Counsel, let me ask you a question along those lines. What standard are you really proposing for the Supreme Court of Ohio today? Because I've read the briefs, I've looked at everything I can look at, and the word fairness seems to be the linchpin. Is that what we're here to talk about?
We're here to talk about that, and some of the appellate opinions, Your Honor, use those terms, fundamental fairness. Some of the cases,
I'm asking you, what phrase do you want to sell this morning?
I want to sell that it violates the right to have justice administered without denial or delay, to be able for 14 years to continually put a man to prosecution.
Counsel, are you relying on the fact that your client was in custody? He was in custody all this time?
He was in custody all this time since August 22nd of 2002.
And the maximum penalty that could have been imposed for a conviction would have been what?
15 years to life. So he's near, and I think I pointed out in the brief that he's near the parole date. Again, I'm not saying that's the dispositive factor, but I'm certainly saying when you look at everything, because one of the things that we have to do, whether it's to go back to Justice O'Neill's question and talk about Article 1, Section 16, or Section 1, or the Due Process Clause, one of the things that we have to be able to do as a justice system, and one of the things that we think the court has to lead in that regard, is we have to be able to say, look at this case. Whether you agree with the result or you don't agree with the factual result, what has happened here has been the fair administration of justice. What has happened here has been due process. And can we really stand up and say, in the United States of America, where we have due process of law, where we have these provisions in our own Constitution guaranteeing the inalienable right to defend oneself, guaranteeing...
But, counsel, he was able to do all that four times, was he not? He had four trials. It would be a different matter if he would have been arrested and detained in 2003 and a mistrial declared, and we've been waiting and waiting and waiting since then for another trial that will result in not a mistrial, because at this point he's had four mistrials, correct?
Five.
He's had four mistrials. That's
okay.
Correct.
All right. So
weren't there five?
No.
Not mistrials, Your Honor. There was The first mistrial.
Well, his counsel fell asleep in one of them, right?
That's correct.
What would you have done in a case like that?
If I were the trial judge?
Sure.
I think what the trial judge did, which was, I guess there's a semantic argument whether he continued the case or whether he declared a mistrial. We were in the middle of voir dire when a juror blurts this out. To me, the trial has commenced. But the issue of semantics, and we don't have any argument with what Judge Evans did in that case. We think that's what he had to do. We don't have any argument that there's not a manifest necessity under the Perez case.
All right, getting back to the question that I was working on before we talked about how many trials he's had, there has been a process that has been taking place in the four trials. It's not like he has been in limbo with nothing happening on behalf of the state, correct?
That's true.
Okay, so basically you're saying enough is enough. Based on fundamental fairness, this needs to end because of what? Why?
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Madam Chief Justice, is there's a lot of moving parts in this, and that is certainly part of it. And it's a different argument if there hadn't been any trials, and I'd probably be here under a different constitutional argument.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is, can we, because the Double Jeopardy Clause simply says that if you have a hung jury, you can keep retrying somebody, can we continue to go on and on?
Why can't
I think maybe we can standing alone, but that's why I say there's a lot of moving parts in
okay,
a case
so
like this.
Okay, so let's say that it was a hung jury, although these weren't all hung juries. Obviously, it was for behavior during the trial that a mistrial was declared.
Correct.
In at least one of these.
I would probably argue, too, the witness blurting something out and the conduct of the co-counsel.
Yeah, but I would have maybe looked at that as being a continuance because new counsel was appointed and...
If I may, not to interrupt you, but that's actually incorrect.
Okay.
He was sitting there as co-counsel. I was not the guy who fell asleep. I guess I'm responsible because it was my voir dire, maybe, who put him to sleep.
All right, there you go.
Co-counsel.
There you go. You accept some responsibility.
And so there was not a replacement of counsel. There was simply a rescheduling of the trial.
Okay. So, yes, if we would have had a series of mistrials, but there were hung juries here, and you do concede that a hung jury opens the door for a new prosecution.
I do. That seems to go all the way back to Perez.
Okay. So that's not an argument in your favor.
I'm joking.
Besides fundamental fairness, give me something else, please.
Well, and what I was suggesting to Justice O'Neill is that fundamental fairness is really just some courts using the terms due process of law. And I would say under Ohio Constitution, justice administer without denial or delay, because it isn't just a simply a question of putting them back together. I'm running short on my time.
All right, but justice denied or delayed, but here, incrementally, there were trials that were taking place. It wasn't that somebody incarcerated him or detained him and threw away the key, and he's been in limbo all this time. I don't think when those terms have been coined that they were thinking about multiple trials. I think they were thinking about what I just said, somebody in limbo, somebody lingering without their case being addressed at all.
Well, he is to an extent lingering because he sits in jail, they continue to schedule the case for retrial, and there's been prejudice to him other than sitting in trial, which is that, and it's one of the things that it seems to me a lot of folks have overlooked in the briefs, every time you get ready for these cases, there's a substantial investment of time and resources and energy and anxiety, and that has happened five times, even though we've had four mistrials for various reasons. That's happened five times.
And the five times were continued. How many did you just say that you've prepared for trial five times?
Oh, between me and Mr. Anderson's original counsel,
you're
sure.
You're talking about the trials that took place.
No, ma'am. I'm also talking about trials that you have to prepare for. We just, for example, in the case where the co-counsel fell asleep,
right.
We simply didn't pick up the file and walk into court and say, it's time to pick a jury. We had to go over the transcripts. We had to prepare direct
okay,
and cross-examination.
So you had to do your job.
Correct.
Okay, so why is that a detriment?
Because the cases, I think, say so. The cases that talk about if you, the dissenting opinion that I cited at the end of my brief in the conclusion where the judge says, look, everything else aside, you can look at this provision or that provision, there comes a time when we as a judge have to look at a case as a whole ball of wax and wave the unfairness flag.
Counsel, I keep coming back to this being in custody, and I was trying to test your standard here. Would it have been different if, in this scenario, your client had been able to be on bond, let's say on a very high bond, in between all of the various trials?
Well, he actually is on high bond, but of course he can't post it. And so...
A postable bond, because you had cited the Constitution and the right to liberty and so on. Would that make a difference? That's what I'm trying to ask you.
I don't know that would be to answer your question, I think as directly as I can, a deal breaker, but I certainly think it would be a factor that would go more against the idea that it was a violation. But still rolled into this is the fact, you know, these cases that talk about the fact that the state has to have an opportunity to present its case fully and fairly one time. That's what some of the double jeopardy cases talk about. I know we're not here on double jeopardy, but my point is that that's what they talk about. That's the reason. Well, the state has had that really three times. One time they didn't do it improperly because they admitted evidence they shouldn't have, but two times since then, without that evidence, they've had that full and fair opportunity, and they've not been able to satisfy the Winship standard. And so regardless of the timing, while that might have been a factor, I think it's still time to waive the unfairness.
Mr. Juhas, the delay in this case emanates from a motion filed by yourself to dismiss the sixth trial. Or the latest trial.
The present delay, I would agree.
And that is almost 5 years to this point. Is that fair? Somewhere in 2011 that motion was filed?
I believe that is correct.
So we've been pending on this issue for 5 years. And your argument, if I understand it, is your client's been denied due process.
Correct.
Okay. Has any state Supreme Court made a ruling that a delay like this is a violation of due process? Does your research in that line show anything?
A delay occasioned by the defendant going to court to enforce the right?
Or a mistrial?
Well, I'll address them in two parts. Okay. I have not found a case that says that any of the delay is attributable to the defendant because he's enforcing his own rights through a motion such as this. Some of the cases that are cited in the briefs, I do think address the mistrial situation and say, when there's no new evidence, it's a violation of fundamental fairness, due process, whatever language that particular court wants to use, to say you can continue to put him to trial when there's no new evidence.
But what is your strongest case then? Which case would you have us look at?
I would look at both Abadi, the New Jersey case, and okay. The Moriwaki case from Hawaii.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rivera?
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, my name is Ralph Rivera. I represent the Mahoney County Prosecutor's Office, along with Eric Murphy from the Attorney General's Office. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for Attorney Murphy, please. I'd like to start out with, this is a procedurally unique case. However, this court should look no further than the double jeopardy clause in deciding in whether the trial court abuses discretion in denying the motion to dismiss. This case started—
Counsel, how much is too much? Is there ever such a thing? On what, the second trial, you got a conviction.
Correct.
And then reversed because you brought in the evidence of the biting of another woman and the abuse of another woman.
Correct.
But then you tried him twice more, went—
That's correct.
—through the entire trial and to get two hung juries.
Correct.
In the normal course of things, it seems to me most prosecutors at that point would say, we've done all we can.
I don't know if that's the case.
Would a third trial on a hung jury be enough for not for your prosecutor, maybe nothing's enough, but enough for an appellate court or a trial court to say you've had three shots and you ended up with hung juries on all of them? Stop. At what point does a court have to say, stop, enough's enough?
I don't think we have the answer. There's no case out there.
We're being asked to give an answer.
Yeah, I understand that. I certainly don't think, I think the Seventh District was correct in essentially saying based on all the facts in this case, the procedural history, how long it's been, basically everything that we're talking about, that time has not come. They recognize that there may be a time in the future. But I think certainly the state.
So if you had four and went to trial, first one conviction, reversed on appeal, and then if you got three hung juries after that, would that be the time for a court to say, if your prosecutor said, we're going one more time, for a court to say, no, you're not?
I think it's hard to answer because essentially there's really no, there's obviously several state courts that have addressed this issue, and there's a lot of different examples of how they address these types of, these unique cases. However, in Ohio, we really don't have that, we don't have that map of how we proceed.
But we're being asked to lay it down now.
I think it's the state's position. And so
you're asking us to say three complete trials is not enough. You can have a fourth.
That's correct.
Is that what we are about to write? Or do we say this is unique to the facts here and come out one way or the other based on it being unique to this case and still leave it up in the air?
The state's position is that
for future prosecutors.
In a nutshell, the state's position is that it should be decided simply on double jeopardy. Double jeopardy allows an additional trial following a hung jury. It always has. And I think the court can simply
But is that the argument being made to us today, double jeopardy?
Yes and no. I mean, this case is only before this court because
now we've got yes and no. What?
No. The proposition of law deals with due process.
Okay.
The only reason this case—
So you want us to jump over and to double jeopardy?
Well, double jeopardy has always allowed an additional trial following a hung jury.
If it's double jeopardy and that's the only standard, then there is no enough is enough.
That's correct. And I just would like to point the court's attention to Flowers versus the state of Louisiana. It was a 2014 case out of the Supreme Court of Louisiana. It was actually very similar to this case. From the time of indictment until the defendant was actually convicted was over 13 years, which is similar to this case. In that case, the Supreme Court affirmed the conviction after his sixth trial. The first three were reversed based on some type of error. The first two were based on some type of prosecutorial misconduct.
So is Louisiana the standard that we should apply in Ohio?
The state would,
Southern
yes.
Justice?
It's the most favorable case to the state's position, absolutely.
But counsel, in Ohio, though, we have the Ohio Constitution that speaks to a justice without denial or delay. Does that change things a bit?
It certainly can. I mean, this court, I think to find any type of relief or to get to that fairness argument, I think the court would absolutely have to analyze the case under the Ohio Constitution and rather than the federal Constitution, because essentially the question or the issue in Louisiana was federal due process does not apply. You don't get any more rights. You don't get any more double jeopardy rights through the due process clause. That's essentially how the case was decided. So it would absolutely have to be based on the Ohio Constitution.
So tell us what your argument is, why it doesn't violate the Ohio Constitution then.
It doesn't violate the Ohio Constitution. When you take into consideration the factors that other courts, state courts have, and there's been a couple cases out of district courts, not including the 7th District, obviously. There was one in the 9th, which was Roper and Whiteside. And they essentially considered several factors. Now, none of the courts agreed on any of the factors, but they essentially considered several factors that were relevant to the case.
Do you think the 7th District's list of factors, is that the list that we should adopt?
I stated in my brief, I don't advocate any adoption of any specific factors.
Wouldn't it be better, in terms of us giving advice to other prosecutors in your position, wouldn't it be better to have at least a list of factors that could be considered?
Quite possibly. I think a better approach is to consider factors that are relevant to the case. Some factors may not be relevant to the case at all, and they may not lend any type of helping hand. But the factors that are present in this case, and it was kind of discussed, the length of time. However, throughout this 13 plus years, the defendant has received his due process rights, and he's received them based on when there was inadmissible evidence or improper evidence, the court granted the mistrial. Following the conviction, he received, was granted a reversal of his conviction, given a new opportunity without that evidence.
Counsel, are you agreeing that, I'm over here, are you agreeing therefore that possibly is one of the standards, whether on an individualized basis due process has been afforded? And the reason I ask that is because I'm a little troubled by the Louisiana approach where you can have prosecutorial misconduct followed by subsequent trial where there's prosecutorial misconduct followed by a subsequent trial. Certainly you will agree that violates a basic sense of fairness.
It's hard to say exactly what exactly happened, but
we'll just use it as a hypothetical then. What if the prosecutor just keeps, for example, I think there's a lot of good faith in this case on both sides. I'm not criticizing anyone. But in this case, in the 2006 trial, there was clearly inadmissible evidence was admitted, and it was reversed, correct?
It was reversed based on the admission of that evidence, yes.
And are you saying that weighs on behalf of the prosecution or on the behalf of, oh, good, due process worked, you're only in jail for 3 years this time?
I would agree that the only thing that weighs against the state is the fact that the reversal was based on evidence that the Court of Appeals found was improper. So obviously that does weigh against the state. And the fact that...
Well, you don't question that finding, do you? It was inadmissible prior act evidence, wasn't it?
Well, no. I mean, at this point, it's the law of the case. So I'm not going to stand here and challenge it. And that's... I'm not going to... waste my time debating that issue. It is what it is. It was found improper, and that evidence is being kept out. And in the subsequent trials, that evidence was being kept out.
So, counsel, your bottom line is, as long as it's not violative of the double jeopardy standard, it is retriable.
Absolutely.
And you've had two trials with the same evidence, both resulting in mistrials.
Well, it's somewhat confusing. The last two trials where there was a hung jury, the state presented the same evidence, yes.
Okay.
Now, the defendant put on evidence in his case in chief that was not put on in the original 2006 trial.
Okay. But essentially, then, if the case goes back for retrial without discovery of additional evidence, presumably the state would present the same evidence.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the state has always essentially presented the same evidence in a legal term. There is no new evidence as used.
Well, you've got DNA evidence here. You've got scrapings underneath her fingernails that had the defendant's DNA and saliva from the bite mark on her breast, right?
Yes.
And that is,
has that been challenged by an expert on behalf of the defendant?
That, no. So no, it has never been challenged.
It's uncontroverted evidence that this is the DNA of the defendant.
Yeah, yes.
And his defense was what, consensual?
Yes. It's in the subsequent trials, yes.
But that wasn't his original defense.
Well, there was no defense, as in there was no witness testimony. The defendant himself has taken the stand in subsequent trials.
Okay. All right. Thank you. You've used your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Murphy. You've got about 3.5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Madam. Excuse me, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin with Justice Pfeiffer's question. And the question we're here today is there an answer to the enough is enough question with respect to due process? And my answer with respect to due process is no. And the reason for that is, as the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly said, when there's a specific constitutional provision in place, you go to that provision and not to vague notions of due process. Here, that is double jeopardy, and there's no dispute that there's been a double jeopardy problem. In other cases, though, there very well may be a double jeopardy problem. Going to Justice O'Neill's question, about the hypothetical of prosecutorial misconduct, the U.S. Supreme Court did say in Oregon versus Kennedy that if a mistrial is caused by prosecutorial misconduct because the prosecutor doesn't like the jury, because the prosecutor thinks there's going to be an acquittal, that would violate double jeopardy.
Well, let me ask you this. I'd like to direct you to Justice O'Donnell's question. You now have two hung juries with the same evidence, same proper evidence. The jury has said, I'm not buying it. You haven't proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. Is it your position that the double jeopardy clause permits the prosecutor to just reload and keep going until they get a conviction?
The double jeopardy clause and the due process clause do not prohibit retrial after a hung jury.
I want to know your position on behalf of the state.
Absolutely, yes. It does not prohibit retrial. That doesn't mean that there's no limits, however. For instance,
Let's talk about limits.
Most of the cases rely on non-constitutional provisions. Most of the cases on
I'm
which my
about
friend on the other
stay side. With double jeopardy, and really,
that's
I want to make sure I understand the state of Ohio is saying they can try a person as many times as they want and continue getting hung juries until they win.
It does not violate the double jeopardy clause, would be our position. That does not mean that there are not other remedies that are more narrowly tailored. For instance, most of the other cases rely on statutory provisions that say that the court has discretion to dismiss in the interest of justice. These cases are interpreting either criminal rules of procedure or criminal statutes.
Well,
those could be implicated here.
Which statute would be implicated?
Well, in Ohio's situation, as we cite in the brief, it would be Criminal Rule Procedure 48B, which this court interpreted in State versus Bush to allow for an interest of justice analysis. But that would not be a constitutional ruling. That would be a ruling on the interpretation of the meaning of that rule.
And that would be for the trial court to decide.
Absolutely. The key difference is it would be, as State versus Bush clearly indicated, it would be highly deferential abuse of discretion review on appeal rather than the de novo review
That's not something this court could employ.
Certainly not now. The proposition of law is limited to the constitutional due process. And so with respect to due process, when there's a specific constitutional provision in place, you rely on that constitutional provision rather than the vague notions of due process.
And Mr. Murphy, do you concur that the Flowers case from Louisiana is the best or strongest case that the state has?
Flowers, as well as if you want a case from a northern state, as Serb.
Some people, of our people, members
people, people versus Serb, although that's Michigan, Your Honor. People versus Serb is Michigan. And that case basically adopted the same analysis and said that when there's a specific provision in place, double jeopardy, you don't rely on notions of due process.
So you would say that the Ohio Constitution sections, Article 1, Section 10 and 16 that are specifically talking about justice without delay, the speedy trial, et cetera, are not violated in situations like this?
No. Yes, I would say that they are not violated. The court has already said in State versus Gardner that the due process clause in the state constitution is analogous to the due process clause in the federal constitution, and so that would bring in the federal cases.
But that doesn't mean that we have to follow the federal constitution. We can always say that Ohio is more protective of rights, of individual rights, than is the federal constitution.
But you have to provide a rationale for why, and I don't think that this provision is tailored to the criminal process. You mentioned speedy trial. That's not this provision is not the speedy trial clause. The speedy trial clause is actually in the criminal procedure provisions of the Ohio Constitution, which are Article 1, Section 10, not Article 1, Section 16. Article 1, Section 16's plain language suggests that it's more tailored to the civil context. It says the court shall be open, and people shall have a remedy in court for injuries caused them by outsiders. So it's more focused on the civil context than the criminal context. The criminal context is Article 1, Section 10. And that just reiterates what the U.S. Supreme Court has said, that when there's a specific provision in place, here the most analogous specific provision is the Double Jeopardy Clause, you rely on that clause and not vague notions of due process. If there are no other questions, I respectfully request that you affirm the 7th District.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, and I'll, since I have just that minute, I'll just address the last point, which goes to the Ohio Constitution and all this talk about the Due Process Clause. One of the cases that I cited in there was a 1927 case called Thomas against Mills, written by Ohio's first female Supreme Court Justice, Florence Allen, and in that case, she used Article 1, Section 16 in talking about the right of an incarcerated defendant to meet with his lawyer. The warden would not allow him to meet with his lawyer, and she relied on that provision. So I think there's two points to be drawn from
that. Well, counsel, that's not what we have here.
Well, but I think it certainly rebuts the claim that it applies only to civil cases, Your Honor,
one. But it doesn't help you. Because you know we're not dealing with that.
I think it helps to the extent that you're right as to the specific provision that can a lawyer meet with his incarcerated client after trial. Of course not. But I think the point is, Article 1, Section 16 doesn't say that. It says that you shall have justice denial and administer without denial or delay. And in that particular case, that was the denial of justice.
Okay, but
here
but,
we have a different one.
All right, but here. I mean, if we want to look at the cause for the delay, you've had a motion pending for 4 years, 5 years?
And
the motion to dismiss?
So, and I don't mean to be glib about this, but I mean, what's the defendant's course of action? Does he then say, well, my constitutional rights are being violated, but geez, if I file a motion, it's going to be held against me?
No, I'm not being saying this is being held against you, but it is. There's been the time has passed due to motions and procedures and activity by both sides. It's not as though the prosecutor here is solely responsible for the fact that time has passed and a resolution has not taken place.
That is true, and I don't want to belabor this too long, but I think I have to answer your question. If the court will recall, when we appealed to the Court of Appeals from the denial of the motion to dismiss, the state said, nuh-uh, it's not a final appealable order. And when the Court of Appeals finally said, yes, it is, before there was a final appealable order, the state appealed to this court. And so a lot of time was added to the case simply with that procedural wrangle. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong about that. What I am suggesting is while all that was going on with lawyers and judges, Chris Anderson was sitting in jail.
You would agree that this is a highly unusual procedural track that this case has taken.
Yes, ma'am, I would.
And it is not by any stretch the norm.
I would agree with that as well.
This is a one-off, so to speak.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you will be notified of our decision.